Welcome to the Cumbria Chamber of Commerce podcast, your regular update of business news and issues from around Cumbria. Find out how we support new business and help existing businesses to grow and flourish at cumbriachamber.co.uk. Now here's the Chamber's Business Engagement Manager, Julian Whittle, with the latest episode.
Hello, I'm here with Francis Cameron and Luke Donnickley from the law firm Muckle. Francis is an employment law specialist and Luke is a commercial contract specialist. And we're looking at the implications of the coronavirus outbreak for businesses. Welcome, both of you. We're seeing a daily escalation in the number of cases, and the government has published a coronavirus action plan where the worst case scenario envisages that 80% of the population will become infected at some point, and staff absenteeism rates in businesses could reach 20% at any one time. That's a fairly apocalyptic vision. What I wondered, Francis, what should employers be doing now? What contingency planning arrangements should they be putting in place?
Good afternoon, Julian. May I suppose start by saying that whatever guidance I give today is effective at the 13th of March 2020 and up to date as at 1 p.m. Unfortunately, yes. It's changing on a very dramatic and quick basis. So any guidance I do give is dependent, it is very much Good dependent trend. On it being 13th of March at the moment. Essentially, what should employers be doing now? Well, it really comes down to the nature and size of your business. The best advice, and I'm sure you've all been doing this anyway, is keep up to date with the government guidance. I understand the website is being updated at 2 p.m. every day. The ACAS guidance is also fantastic. They've got a really good website with a large section now dedicated to coronavirus. But more generally, I think start contingency planning if you haven't done already. For instance, in our business as a law firm, there is the possibility from working from home, asking some employees to work agilely. If you have a business of this nature, you should be looking into this already. You should be asking employees to check that their laptops and any other equipment they use works from home and is available. Try and get them to attach to your network via home and ensure that your security programs are in place and up to date. In addition, it might be worthwhile getting a number of the workforce to stress test how the systems work. If everyone logged on from home at the same time, could you attempt to get half the workforce, for instance, to log in and see what happens to the system? With bigger businesses, I've heard of some city banks, for example, and larger businesses trying to split their workforce in order to minimise contact between individuals. I have to say, I think in our region and for many SMEs, this is just simply not practical. This seems to be very much the advice that is, or some of the guidance that is out there in London, but it's not necessarily as applicable in the north. Especially where, you know, key infrastructure roles such as IT are needed across sites. And so it's just simply not possible to split staff into lots of different teams. However, what you should be looking at instead is whether there are business critical roles or tasks that need to be done during a period of shutdown. And this will help you to determine what your skeleton staff might look for or look like, rather. It's not going to work for all businesses, of course. I appreciate that in the manufacturing sector, for example, where people need to be physically on site, it's going to be very tricky in the current circumstances and in the event of any shutdown. So the basic advice is, as the government says, try and provide staff with preventative hygiene measures if possible. Ensure that there's hand sanitizers available. Encourage people to wash their hands. Try to avoid sharing equipment. Ask colleagues not to shake hands. If they're meeting clients, for example, customers, try and avoid shaking hands. I'm afraid this all sounds very practical, straightforward advice, but unfortunately there's not an awful lot more that employers can be doing at the moment.
Okay, I wonder, are there any key messages that businesses should be relaying to their staff and customers?
Again, no easy answer to this. The first thing I think is in light of what was announced yesterday by Boris Johnson, that if any employees are showing any coronavirus symptoms at all, then whether that's a continuous cough or a high temperature, they should be staying at home for at least 7 days. So the first things first is make sure that your staff and any customers are aware of this. I would then also suggest trying to avoid triggering any kind of frenzied panic by suggesting or sending out emails that seem maybe over heightened or overly paranoid at this time, which is difficult. But instead, maybe try to focus on the positive steps that employees and customers could be taking. For example, as I've already highlighted, there's lots of hygiene measures that could be followed. There are other reassuring, I suppose, measures that you could be telling staff and customers. For example, if you have appointed a small task force that has a daily call to agree next steps, tell your customers and your staff that you've done this. Tell them who those people are. If they have any questions, they can contact those people. And also highlight to staff where communications will be posted. For instance, if you have a section on your intranet that deals with coronavirus, then that would be the appropriate place to send communications out. Alternatively, if you have emergency personal contact details for staff, it would be worth ensuring that people have updated those contact details and remind them that this will be the way they are contacted once or if there is a business shutdown. So if you've got a method of getting messages out to the workforce quickly and effectively, it's making sure that those mechanisms are in place now.
Now, you mentioned that, the hand washing. Are there any other practical precautions to take in the workplace, in business premises? And also, you know, could a business be liable if it fails to take reasonable steps to protect staff and customers?
Employers are under both statutory and common law duties to protect the health and well-being of their employees. So yes, the basic measures I've already mentioned are, you know, the primary things we need to be thinking about. However, on a more deeper level, I suppose you have to consider whether there are any particular vulnerable members of your staff. For example, if you have any people that are over the age of 70 or have any underlying health conditions, it would be worth over the coming few days and weeks to keep those people under review. And there may come a time, I'm not necessarily saying we've reached that yet, but there may come a time where you have to ask those people either to work from home or to self-quarantine. I think we'll be very much guided by the government on when that time has come. Looking to the longer term future, you asked about whether employers can be held liable. Yes, for example, there is a duty to make reasonable adjustments to the workplace in relation to disabled people. And that might be, for instance, if someone had a respiratory condition, looking at ways of them working independently from anyone else in order to avoid this virus. Yep, yep. And so there are possibilities of claims in the long-term future. But I think at this time, at the moment, I would be concentrating on trying to keep your workforce safe and not worrying too much about the long-term potential liability. If you continue to keep up to date with government guidance and act reasonably in all the circumstances, I think and I would hope that most allegations are kept to a minimum.
What about business travel? Should businesses curtail this? And again, I suppose, is there a risk of being sued if, for example, you send an employee to a trade fair and they get infected while they're there?
Good question. I mean, I think in light of current government advice and the gradual shutdown of flights and foreign travel, this question will at some point in the near future become almost a moot point. Foreign travel is going to become very difficult in the next few weeks. But essentially, again, it comes down to the duty of care that employers owe towards employees in relation to their health and well-being. And it's very much a question of what is reasonable. So keep up to date with the government's advice on foreign travel. And before making any decisions, thought should be given to whether it's absolutely necessary for that individual to travel to the place they're being requested to go. Where possible, meetings should be convened by video or conference call. And I think that's the best approach you can be taken at the moment.
I think even the Brexit negotiations are going to be done largely by conference call, aren't they, for the next round of those?
That's right.
Now, if an employee becomes ill, presumably, I mean, with coronavirus, presumably normal sick pay arrangements apply, although the rules governing that have changed recently, haven't they?
Yeah, so if an employee is ill, the normal sickness pay applies in the sense that the employee will be entitled to whatever sick pay they get under their employment contract. Now, that may be enhanced sick pay or it may be statutory sick pay, which is often referred to as SSP.
Yeah.
However, on the 4th of March, Boris Johnson outlined that statutory sick pay will start from the first day off work and not the fourth day.
Yeah.
And this isn't an attempt to encourage ill people to stay at home. And this is a temporary measure, and we presume that that will lapse at the point that it's no longer needed.
Okay. And what about people who aren't actually ill but are self-isolating? I think the Chancellor announced changes in the budget. They're also entitled to sick pay now, aren't they?
Well, usually when someone stays at home without a specific medical advice to do so, usually there would be no legal requirement to pay them. However, I appreciate this is very unique circumstances that we're facing. And effectively, since I think it was yesterday, people are being asked to almost self-diagnose and then self-isolate because there's the request not to attend GPs or to phone 111. Therefore, people are having to make their own judgment on whether they should self-isolate based on the information available on the internet. Given this, ACAS has said that it's now good practice to pay sick pay if self-isolating. And as I said before, Boris Johnson has outlined that statutory sick pay would be from the first day of work, not from the fourth day. There are some businesses, such as Greggs, that have come out and say they will pay full pay, but I suspect they will need to keep that under review depending on how long self-isolation continues for. And I have to say, most of our clients are not committing to any particular approach at the moment and are instead being guided by what the government is saying.
So, just be clear on this. Is it a requirement to pay sick pay to people who are self-isolating, statutory sick pay, or is it simply good practice?
It's good practice.
Right.
But I think going forward, we will see more and more businesses complying with what Boris Johnson has suggested about SSP. The only thing that concerns me, however, is that smaller businesses are going to struggle with the costs of this. Now, you may have seen that the Chancellor announced earlier this week that businesses with fewer than 250 employees will be able to claim back from the government 2 weeks of SSP paid to staff affected by coronaviruses. However, I think there may be a time that comes where businesses can no longer support paying staff if, even with this additional government support, if, for example, the self-isolation continues beyond 14 days. In such circumstances, I think there may be a point we reach where there is no option but to for employers to approach their employees and ask them to agree to a period of unpaid leave. I have to say this would be an absolute last resort, but if it helped a business from going under and there was no other option, then I think that unfortunately might be the backstop.
Okay. Now, again, this is just for clarification after what you said earlier, but normally, you know, an employer would require an absent employee to get a sick note from their GP. That no longer is because the government doesn't want GPs to be or the NHS to be overwhelmed. So it's basically up to the individual to self-declare. Is that correct? I understood that right.
Yeah, so individuals who self-isolate with symptoms of COVID-19 should not attend their GP. They're also advised not to call NHS 111 unless their symptoms deteriorate. Also, people are not being tested for coronavirus anymore unless they've been hospitalised. Therefore, increasingly, I'm afraid, employers will have to trust their employees self-reporting on their sickness.
Yeah.
And I think you can go through with them over the telephone to questions like, have they checked their symptoms marry up with the current guidance online? You know, have they got a persistent cough? Have they got a temperature? But beyond that, there's not an awful lot more that employers can be doing. I appreciate that that's frustrating, but this is a very, very unusual scenario, and I think flexibility is going to be required.
Now, what's the situation if an employer tells an employee, don't come to work, perhaps because, you know, they've just returned from an infected area. Is there a requirement for the employer to pay that employee?
Yes, I think so. ACAS guidance suggests that where the employer has told the employee not to come into work when they are not sick, they should be paid in full. This is because it's akin to a suspension. You'll appreciate that ordinarily this type of scenario would only happen when you're asking an employee not to come into work, usually because you're worried about their conduct or something. That's the closest equivalent I can think of. However, I'm not sure whether the government might issue further guidance on this in the coming days and weeks, because I appreciate that this is not a very happy answer for me to be giving you. So I think keep up to date with the government guidance on that point.
And what's the situation if an employee needs to take time off, perhaps to look after a sick dependent or maybe to look after their children because the school's been closed?
Yeah, again, a very difficult situation. Employees are entitled to take time off work to care for their dependents. This is under legislation, and this would cover where they have to take time off because their school is closed or because they suspect a dependent themselves are ill. However, there's no statutory right to be paid in those circumstances. An emergency dependence leave is usually only for a very short period of time of 1 to 2 days whilst the employee arranges alternative childcare. I think, again, this might be something that the government has to revisit over the coming few days and weeks, because actually for a lot of people, emergency childcare would be grandparents. But as you've, as I've already mentioned, those people that are over the age of 70 are more at risk. And so I wouldn't be surprised if at some point there is further guidance given in, you know, exactly this scenario.
Now, what if an employee doesn't want to come to work, perhaps because they're afraid of maybe catching the virus on public transport on the way or something like that? They say they don't want to come in. How should a responsible employer respond to that?
The response will need to be tailored depending on the personal circumstances of that individual employee that has requested the that they don't come into work or stated that they're not coming into work, and also the industry in which they work. You need to give due consideration to each individual request and be able to show that your rationale behind any decision made is appropriate and reasonable in the circumstances. I think in the current climate, employees that make this statement will be looked upon somewhat more favourably than ordinarily when someone refuses to come into work. Clearly, that would normally be misconduct, but in the circumstances, and particularly given what I've already mentioned about the requirement to make reasonable adjustments for someone who's disabled, I think you need to try and understand the employee's concerns. They may be disabled themselves, or they may be looking after someone who is disabled, and they may have good reason to want to stay at home in those circumstances. So I think also you could be considering whether there are any practical solutions. For example, are they in a role that could work from home, or could they attend telephone via telephone meetings, for example? Again, this is an evolving set of circumstances that there is no clear answer to. But I think the main thing is to just consider that specific employee's request and whether they've got good rationale for it.
What if an employee becomes ill at work and you as employer suspect they may have coronavirus? What should you do?
Well, first of all, employers should be mindful of the expectation of privacy for employees around their medical information. So I wouldn't get wrapped up in the panic and forget about this and start telling everyone in the workforce that Johnny has got coronavirus. Instead, the government's advice stands about asking that person to go home and then to stay at home for 7 days. The current advice doesn't seem to be as drastic as closing and disinfecting the business premises.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you that next. So that's not the case then.
Yeah, no. It doesn't appear to be, although I am aware of businesses that have done this in response. But I think carefully monitoring the situation is the best course of action, keeping a close eye out, for example, for other colleagues showing any symptoms. Mm. And, you know, if the virus does start to become widespread, then it would be at that point necessary to shut down and ask people to work from home if at all possible. It is very much an evolving picture. So I think over the coming weeks, as the virus spreads further and further, then it may come a point that businesses do have to shut down in the event that they feel they simply cannot keep everything as clean and as sterile as they would like to.
And if your business does close under those circumstances, do you still have to pay your staff?
Again, as I've mentioned earlier, if you've got employees that are able to work from home, then they should be encouraged to do so, and they'd be entitled to their full pay as normal. In ordinary circumstances where a business closes as a result of unforeseen circumstances, for example, a flood or a fire, then employees would be entitled to receive their normal pay unless they had been consented to being laid off or have agreed to a period of unpaid leave. However, in the event that in these circumstances, I think it's very different. The legal position is as yet unclear and is unprecedented. I think if you were able to shut down and do a deep clean only for a day or two and then open back up, I think it would probably be reasonable to pay normal pay or at least sick pay. But in the event that there's a general close down by the government, then it's as I've described previously. I think the government will give advice on this, and it's likely to be that SSP is extended to this set of circumstances.
So staff would receive SSP even though they're not actually sick?
Yes.
I mean, you mentioned staff taking leave. Can an employer, is this a request, or can an employer require staff to use part of their holiday entitlement for the duration of any closure? And can you, likewise, when you mentioned working from home, is that something the employer can insist upon, or is it simply a request that the employee has to consent to?
Yeah, so under the working time regulations, an employer can require staff to take statutory holiday, annual leave on specified dates. The notice given must be twice the length of the leave that the worker is being ordered to take. So if they're being asked to take 2 weeks holiday, they would...
4 weeks notice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Again, employers should be acting reasonably and flexibly in the circumstances. I would not recommend forcing employees to use all of their holiday now because, unfortunately, we're still early on in the year. We're only in March. And you might find that employees use all of their holiday in one go in circumstances that they are forced to sit at home. And therefore, it's not going to be considered reasonable, I think, if they have no holiday left for the rest of the year. But, you know, if you did have a temporary closure of a day or two, then this may be something that you could consider agreeing with staff.
Provided you give the notice.
Yes. And in relation to working from home, staff can be asked to work from home, and in that situation they will be entitled to their full pay.
But is it... You said asked, so can the employer require them to do that, or does it require their consent to work from home?
Well, it depends on what the employment contract specifically says, but I think in the current circumstances, I think it's not unreasonable to require them to work from home, actually.
Yeah. I mean, many businesses are already seeing a downturn in trade as a result of consumer behaviour changing. Are they able to lay off staff or introduce short-time working?
This is a difficult question. It's likely to depend on the circumstances that you are facing. It shouldn't be done on a whim, as it could be perceived to be a breach of employment contract. And in normal circumstances, there is no contractual right to lay off staff or to introduce short-time working unless it's specifically or expressly set out in their employment contract. I do appreciate, though, in the current circumstances, that some businesses, as I mentioned earlier, may start to come up against financial difficulty and therefore be forced to consider these options. I think if you are facing those circumstances, you need to have a method of communicating with the staff, perhaps by the emergency contact details we've already talked about. And ideally, you should be seeking agreement with them that there will be a period of unpaid leave, given the highly unusual circumstances, And in that case, the measure should be implemented for no longer than is reasonably necessary. Ultimately, if redundancies are the only viable option, then there might be something you have to consider. However, I would always recommend that you seek employment advice before announcing such draconian measures. And usually there is a requirement to go through a period of consultation before you reach that point.
Thanks, Frances. Luke, if I could move to you, what about contracts? Would coronavirus allow a business to trigger a force majeure clause, for example, to terminate a lease early?
Yeah, okay. So force majeure clauses are clauses which allow a party to suspend certain of their obligations under a contract. So it could be any commercial contract. Mm-hmm. You really have to look at the wording of the force majeure clause to understand what's going on with it. So I think the sensible thing to start with is let's have a look at a force majeure clause. So I've got one here. And what it says is where either party is totally or partially prevented or delayed in the performance of any of its obligations by a force majeure event, performance of the effective obligation is excused from the date a notice is given to the other party until the force majeure event ceases. So there's lots going on here. First thing to ask is, well, what is a force majeure event? Force majeure events are traditionally known as acts of God. So they tend to cover things like hurricanes, floods, earthquakes, any sort of natural disaster, civil commotion, so on and so forth. Unfortunately, under English law, there's no actual definition of what a force majeure event is. It is what you agree as contracting parties.
Right.
Okay? So you have to look at your contract and say, well, what actually does the contract say a force majeure event is? Now, many, many contracts will contain the word epidemic or pandemic. So it might well be that the epidemic or the pandemic is covered. Mm. If you look at your force majeure clause and it doesn't say epidemic or pandemic, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't treat it as a force majeure event, because if your lawyers have drafted the clause in a certain way, it will cover all events that are outside your control. So again, to give you an example, the wording in this particular clause defines a force majeure event as any cause or event affecting the performance of this agreement arising from attributable acts, events, non-happenings, or accidents beyond the reasonable control of the party. So that clause is saying, look, literally anything in your anything that happens, anything that stops you from performing that's outside your control can be a force majeure event, but it may also include acts of God, nature, you know, natural disasters, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So it might well be that even if your clauses don't mention epidemic or pandemic, then you're absolutely fine. If you clear that hurdle, if the force majeure event applies to an epidemic or a pandemic, that's only part of the story.
Right.
Because you then have to prove causation. It's no good just saying, well, we've got an epidemic or a pandemic, we can stop performing under the contract. No, that's wrong.
Right.
The epidemic has to actually stop you from performing something. So if you can continue to perform under the contract, your force majeure clause won't apply. The other thing to point out is that, again, it depends on the way the clause is drafted, but it often won't apply to a whole contract. It'll only apply to those parts of the contract that you can't actually perform. So if the force majeure event comes along, something happens, part of your business is affected but the rest of your business isn't, then under the terms of that contract you have to keep performing those parts of the contract that you can still do anyway. So it's not a panacea. The other thing to remember about force majeure is that we're talking about a virus here, and the tendency is to think, well, actually, this is about people getting ill. This is about people getting sick. This is about people in my business not being able to come in and work, or people in my supply chain letting me down. Remember, it can also, if it's about events outside the control of the parties, that can be a government action. Okay, so you could be talking about a force majeure event where a government says, right, Cumbria is in lockdown. No one in or out of Cumbria. But if that prevents you from performing your contract, then that too could be a force majeure event. It's not just the effect of the virus, it's itself. The other thing to think about with force majeure clauses is, again, in the way that they're drafted, there are lots of hidden nasties in there. So, for example, it might say, well, the force majeure event only starts and only allows you to stop performing under the contract where you tell the other party that that's the case. So there'll be a notices clause. If you don't comply with it, it doesn't matter if you can't perform, you haven't told the other party. The other thing you often see is a duty to mitigate. So it will say something like, if you can't perform, that's fine, but you have to take reasonable steps to perform in a different way. So one party might be granting a right to another party, and it might not be able to perform under the force majeure clause. And if there's that mitigation wording in there, then you might say, well, you have to find a different right you can give to the other party. So really, these force majeure clauses are great, but you have to be very, very careful and understand that they are very limited. They're also a double-edged sword, because depending on the situation, you might actually want to try and stop the force majeure clause from applying because you don't want your supplier to rely on it. You want to keep that supply. Yeah. So you'll be asking them to say, well, can you prove to me that actually this is stopping you from performing? Yeah. How do you prove that? So on and so forth.
Difficult one. Mm. And if you can't rely on a force majeure clause, I presume there's not much you can do. For example, if you couldn't fulfil a contract because of coronavirus, and that triggered penalty clauses, would there be a way to avoid that?
Well, it really depends on the contract. I mean, to take the penalty clause example, you would hope there's a force majeure clause. Mm. If there isn't, then there are other things available under English law. So there is something called the doctrine of frustration. So this is where you have a contract, something happens that makes the contract impossible to perform. Not just a bit difficult, not just commercially unviable, but we cannot perform this anymore. It's a very, very high bar. If it can't be performed, then a court might find that the contract has been frustrated and that therefore it can't be performed by either party anymore. And that might act to end the contract.
Right.
So that's something to think about. But you would probably only get to the situation of relying on frustration where basically you're getting sued by someone and it would be for court to decide. So much better to rely on something in the contract that both the parties can see. Of course, the other thing to bear in mind is that what a force majeure clause often does is it suspends the party's obligations whilst the force majeure event's going on.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily terminate the contract.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And again, it depends on the wording. Sometimes you do see clauses that say things like, if the force majeure event goes on for a particular number of days, say 30 days, then the parties can end the contract. But it might not say that at all, so there might be no right to terminate whatsoever.
Right, okay. Now, I would like to finish with a couple of specific questions, because as a chamber, we are starting to get questions now from businesses. And here are a couple of the more intriguing ones. The first is from a company that operates self-catering accommodation in the Lake District, or it could equally apply to a hotel or a B&B. And what they were asking is, if a guest shows symptoms of coronavirus, does the operator have to let them stay in the accommodation to self-isolate, even if that prevents other bookings from coming in? Would they then be under an obligation to deep clean the accommodation after the infected person left? And would they be under any obligation to tell future guests that, you know, a previous occupant has been infected?
I mean, there's a lot of really interesting questions there, and I'm going to give you, unfortunately, a very lawyerly answer. A very caveated, very lawyerly answer, which is there is no obvious answer to this at law. There's a whole mix of things going on, and I think it's worth picking over them. So, someone operating self-catering accommodation, as you say, could be a hotel, could be a B&B, you've got someone who shows symptoms. Does the operator have to let them stay in the accommodation to self-isolate? I can think of nothing at law that would make the hotel owner obliged to allow the person to stay. But the problem with that answer is I don't think this is necessarily a legal question. There are all sorts of things going on here. And I think it's going to be circumstance specific. If someone in your accommodation has coronavirus, they can get in their car, drive back without seeing anyone to their house in Newcastle and self-isolate there, then probably it would be fair enough to say, if you're fit and well enough to go home, can you go home? But if they live on the other side of the world, does that become a question of morality? Do you want to be saying to them, actually, you ought to leave? Because not only might they not be able to make that journey, but how many people are they going to come across? There's no self-isolation there. The other question, obviously, is one of public relations. Do you want to be seen kicking someone essentially out of your accommodation if they have to self-isolate? So it really isn't a simple legal answer. Yeah. There might be a legal answer to it. You might well be able to say to them, yes, you can leave, but it doesn't make it the practical or commercial thing to do.
I suppose there could be a legal implication for the people who are hoping to stay with you the following week. If you say, if you let somebody stay to self-isolate, yes, they could say, well, yeah, you know, you breached your contract with me.
Yeah, and again, there's lots of things going on there. I think there would generally be an understanding that if someone was self-isolating and you had, as the owner of some accommodation, said, well, actually, they have to stay here because they're self-isolating, you would hope that most people in that situation would say, well, okay, fair enough. The other thing to think about is, we've talked about deep cleaning, we'll come on to that in a minute. Were I to be staying in a hotel in the Lake District, and the hotel were to ring me and say, actually, there's someone self-isolating there at the minute, I don't think I'd be saying to them, I really want to come to your hotel next week. These things I think will disappear in the practicalities of it. On the assumption that that were to happen, you would hope that there would be some sort of booking terms and conditions, and those booking terms and conditions would probably allow the hotel to say, actually, we can't give you it because of X, and then there'll be a refund policy. Yeah. So something will cover it.
What about the second part of that question is what about your obligations to future guests? I mean, about around deep cleaning and perhaps telling them, saying, you know, previous occupant has had the coronavirus, do you still want to come?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a question of a duty of care here. And I do think what you shouldn't be doing is exposing people to unnecessary risk. And if you think that there's been a coronavirus outbreak in your accommodation, personally, my advice would be you really do need to be telling guests about that, because you would not want to be faced with a situation in which someone comes in, gets coronavirus, and then brings a claim against you. Now, I know it's a completely different jurisdiction, but I know that some of the passengers on one of the cruise liners have taken out a lawsuit in the US against the cruise line operators for the way in which they've handled this. Often in the US you get lots of litigation. It's not quite the same in the UK, but I don't think it's impossible that if you expose someone to that risk, you would have a problem with it. And in terms of deep cleaning, I mean, I think you would have to deep clean your accommodation. But again, one wonders how the practicalities of this are going to swallow things up, because you may find that you're worried about things like telling guests whether there's been coronavirus here. But if government is to be believed, and this is a pandemic and it affects the UK, in quite a bad way, then this is going to be something that's faced probably by most hotels, most B&Bs and so on. Yeah. And so if you say, well, we've had a coronavirus case, you are really not going to be the only person dealing with that. Then everybody will be.
Okay. Another one which I think will be a lot more straightforward is a lady who runs a tutoring business.
Yeah.
And she's saying if schools close, and one of the biggest schools in Carlisle has already been closed, if schools close, do I have to stop tutoring as well?
It's interesting. It would be interesting to know more about the tutoring business. I mean, again, we have to caveat this with it depends on what the government says, because as we record this podcast, the government hasn't closed any schools. Now, for the sake of argument, in 2 or 3 days' time, let's say the government does decide to close some schools. The guidance may go as far as to say it applies to personal tutors. It might go as far as to say it applies to nurseries, to private nurseries, to public nurseries, and so on. At the minute, we can't say. But actually, this is not necessarily a question about education, because it will depend on where the people are being taught. Are they being taught in a school's premises? Are they being taught in a person's house? That might play into it. Actually, it might well be that the government bans gatherings of a certain number of people. And in fact, it might be something like that stops the tutor from tutoring. So it really is keeping an eye on the guidance. I wouldn't have thought that a closing schools guidance from the school would stop that per se, but that depends on how far the government goes with this guidance.
Okay, well, thanks very much, both of you. As we've been saying, it's a fast-moving picture. The best way to keep up to date is to consult Cumbria Chambers' Coronavirus Toolkit, which actually brings together advice from the NHS, the Foreign Office, the World Health Organization, ACAS, and other bodies. It's on the Chamber website, cumbriachamber.co.uk, and we're updating it regularly as new information comes to light.
Thank you for listening to the Cumbria Chamber of Commerce podcast. You can find out more about how we're supporting Cumbrian businesses at cumbriachamber.co.uk. cumbriachamber.co.uk and cumbriagrowthhub.co.uk. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening, and watch out for the next episode, which we'll be releasing very soon.